I think it's a joke, sir. Like, Silius Sodus or Biggest Digger, sir.
What's so funny about Biggest Dickus?
Well, it's a joke name, sir.
I have a very great friend in Rome called Biggest Dickus.
Hello, everyone. This is BungaCast. Welcome back. We're going to bring some big dick energy today. It doesn't matter what you're packing. I think what's important is that the other thinks that you're packing. So we're just going to try to convey some big dick energy, no matter what we've got in our pants. So with me today is, Bunga Boy George, or as usual in London, Phil Cunliffe is away, and we have some wonderful guests, Damage authors and editors both, Christy Offenbacher, who's a clinician in New York City and a founding member of SPI, the Society for Psychoanalytic Inquiry, and Benjamin Fife, who's a clinician in the Bay Area. Hi, Christy. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi.
So,
hi, Alex. You didn't say hi to me, but I'll say hi to you.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, we should say hi.
People know me. I'm not a special guest.
No, but you're a special host. That's the difference. So I want to quote something from an article that we're going to discuss, written by Christy and Ben. Come one, come all, castrated subjects of our time. We have just the thing for you. No more voids, no more questions. It sounds nice, doesn't it? No more worries, no more anxieties. So that's what we're going to be talking about. It's an article which came out in the first print issue of Damage, which came out already at the end of last year. We're already on to issue two, which is coming out kind of as we speak. But we're delving back into issue one, pulling out some really great stuff that's in there. The first issue of Damage called Building Big Things, and that's explored across a range of areas, both in terms of infrastructure and big politics, but also other big things that we're going to be talking about today. So that's in the first issue. The article that Christy and Ben have written, in which we're going to be exploring today, is called Size Queen Nation. To get started, what's going on? What is the phenomenon that you're describing? What is the penis anxiety industry, as you call it?
Well, one of the things that we noticed was that there's been this move in the last, 20 years, from a kind of background noise that occasionally caused rage of people getting, like boner pill spam and advertisements for devices to enlarge their dicks, more recently, where this is just a kind of basic part of the texture of our lives. It's no longer like a moment of like shock. Can you believe how much this is, like how many of these emails I got? It's like, Hims advertising on Instagram. It's the ability to just get a prescription for dick pills without any face-to-face meeting with the physician. And when we looked further into it, there's also this kind of burgeoning industry in penis enlargement that is moving from being a kind of niche surgery to having kind of a multi-level character, where you have the luxury penis enlargement in the form of this Pneuma device, a sheath that gets inserted into the penis that's made of silicone, or a kind of mid-grade option of collagen injections that people assure you are safe because they will, unlike silicone, be reabsorbed into the body, and so you'll have a bigger dick for like 4 years, but then you can go in for more collagen implants, or the kind of used car version, which is like the silicone injected directly into the penis. So we were really interested in like, how is this market developed and what anxieties is it trading in?
Well, that's great. I mean, in preparing this, I was trying to note down some phrases that have become like part of the furniture. They're kind of memes, or they're kind of even ironic mantras, or just kind of the raw material for jokes. I guess they're like, I guess you call it a copy pasta in a way. But all these adverts, right? Of like, do you have like single MILFs in your area or whatever, like that kind of advertising. But there's the things for dicks as well. And that's become kind of the material for jokes. And it's weird how it's just kind of in the ether. I think the first time it hit me that this was a thing that wasn't like any longer sort of giggled about, like, oh, haha, little blue pills and whatever, was listening to the Cumtown podcast, where they were advertising always some like off-brand or, you know, cheaper generic version of boner pills, basically. And I was like, oh, wow, that's like, this isn't done even with a little kind of a little wink and a nod or a little joke. It's just like, yeah, well, this is what we all need. We're all seeking harder penises. So I found that fascinating. Anyway, so the thing that you note about this, Christy, is that like you're right, the trade secret would seem to be that the industry isn't really selling better penises. It is selling the promise of self-assuredness packaged as a bigger package. So could you unpack that for us?
Sure. As Ben said, the penuma is literally a sheath, right? That's covering, it's a protection for something. It indicates that something is vulnerable. And so we were really interested in what is this vulnerability that needs protection in such a concrete way today? And so this drew us to an article, an excellent article by Alex Gendler, and I understand you had him on the podcast. And have maybe talked through this, but he has this argument in his essay, The New Superfluous Men, I think it's called, that outlines the fact that contradictory to the traditional narrative that holds that before feminism, say, or like the sort of conservative traditional narrative that before feminism came in and wrecked everything, traditional patriarchy guaranteed men sex. And guaranteed men kind of, fulfilling lives. And he kind of outlines that actually this is not at all the case. This is kind of a blip on the screen of history that, in the mid, 20th century, in the post-war years, where there was prosperity and stability, men for the first time, had a closer proportion of, kind of, sexual satisfaction to women prior to this period, actually for fascinating, very material reasons, women across history were by far responsible, more responsible for the total amount of reproduction. So he quotes this statistic that, you know, 45,000 years ago, for every three women that, I'm sorry, for every one man that reproduced, three women reproduced. And then in the Middle Ages, think like Genghis Khan sort of era, that increased to for every one man that reproduced, 17 women reproduced. And then in kind of more modern times, that went back down to for every one woman, four men reproduced. And this is for the reason that, just the very concrete reason that women's bodies can only bear so many children in their lifetime. And so for long-term stability of a group survival, you need women much more than you need men, right? So if the majority of a population's males are eliminated from reproduction, you can still repopulate a large number of people through a large number of women that remain. But if the majority of women are wiped out, you are severely restricted in the number of offspring that you can have. And so this kind of positions the female body, as more important for the, stability of a society, of a given society. So he kind of then goes through history and says, well, what then are men for? They're for like hard work. He says that they have their bones. He has this phrase, like their bones were mixed into the mortar of civilization's monuments. So you have this image of, yeah, what are men good for? They might not all be reproducing, but they're working. They're going on dangerous expeditions, you know, across sea, across land to kind of expand territories or defend them in wars. They're just high risk, high mortality jobs and tasks that basically effectively dispose of the excess of men. And so then in contemporary society. So this all to say that men's position in society has always been sort of vulnerable. We've always had an excess of men that we've done one thing or another to get rid of. And today we don't have, you know, war, the nature of war has changed. We don't have outlets to throw, we don't have chasms to like cast our men into. So there are a lot of men, they're very sexually frustrated. They're no longer, you know, post-industrialization, they're no longer as highly prized. The type of work that we're doing doesn't privilege size or strength in the way that it used to. And the soft skills that are traditionally socialized in women take priority. I think he quotes this thing like 80% of jobs lost in the last recession were those that prioritize and privilege size and strength. So men are in a difficult situation to do. There's a lot of men. We're not kind of killing them off in the way that we traditionally have. So yeah, men are vulnerable. They're trying to kind of protect that traditional symbol of stability, of prosperity that once made them able to compete for the very few positions that they had for sexual potency in previous societies. Right. It's not doing much for them.
And now we're all, you know, now we're all online searching for penis enhancement. I say we, I mean, not me, because, you know, I perform a typically and classically masculine role, the podcaster, and we will not be, they will not replace us. So,
yeah, you know. that is one thing that men do seem to be flocking towards. Just one thing though, I did want to just to, I think the you know, Alex Genler's article's great, and you know, it is worth repeating that point that it seems, you know, we've gone back to the standard situation of having superfluous men, but it's, you know, it is a new situation. That's why we have these new superfluous men. But yeah, I mean, so the article is called Size Queen Nation, and I guess I remember you note this in the article that it's only the US and New Zealand that have kind of direct to consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals. And I remember when being in California, seeing, you know, this advertising on the TV when we were picking up the car, Alex and I, which was like for pharmaceuticals. And that was very strange. So is this a particularly kind of American kind of industry, or is it a kind of a global thing? Are these superfluous men in the US watching these adverts, having things, you know, having these drugs particularly advertised to them, or is this a kind of a global shift?
Well, I think we can imagine that the anxieties are fairly global, but the opportunities for capitalizing on those anxieties are fairly regionally specific. So with direct-to-consumer advertising, you're right, it's only the US and New Zealand that where pharmaceutical companies can just make an ad directly to the consumer. And so what happens with pharmaceuticals is as soon as they go off patent, and if they're being produced in, say, like a factory somewhere, you've got this pure profit mechanism where production costs are really low. There's no research that's needed anymore. You might even have some off-label uses that these have been found to be good for. And so you can just put as much of your profit as you want back into direct-to-consumer advertising. So these pharmaceutical companies that are essentially like Xeroxing off-patent drugs, they're making a killing off of the drugs and can just put as many resources as they have into advertising campaigns. And so they get really good at knowing what anxieties people have. They have a reason to kind of hone in on that.
Yeah, I think that comes through, right? The money, the material basis is there to create these anxieties. That advertising always does that really well. Sorry, Alex.
That aspect, the supply side of it, is fairly transparent. Like, okay, people make money off of this. They push their drugs, and we all know how that works. Like, nothing particularly mysterious about that. But on the demand side of it, there's a question to be asked. Like, why is everyone looking for penis enhancement? Harder, bigger penises, basically. What do you call a BHD? Big, hard dick. It's good. But this category of demand, you know, as in supply and demand, is a little bit more difficult to handle, a little bit more difficult to explain, particularly when dealing with sociocultural phenomena. So you break it down into individual, cultural, and unconscious demand. So maybe you could talk us through what this demand is.
Sure. So we were trying to, because this is a phenomenon, it became messy when we kind of observed this phenomenon and then tried to gauge, okay, are men pursuing this because it's what people that they're having sex with are actually asking for from them? Or is this more reflective of a fantasy that they might have of what is wanted from them? So this became kind of the impetus for us making this breakdown into cultural demand, which is like the kind of things that you were saying, how it's become kind of caught up in the background of our lives, like big dick energy and the way that kind of it's big dicks are talked about in advertisements or in kind of daily conversation or in media. And then the individual demand. So sort of overt conscious preferences of the people who interact with these penises. And then unconscious demand. So what sort of we're hearing in our practices when it comes to people experiencing a demand for them to be big and hard.
And here psychoanalytic thinking is really useful too, because one of the ideas about what how our defenses against vulnerability work kind of on a universal level is that sometimes people want something really concrete when they're really anxious, something that just holds all of the kind of symbolic potential without being felt as symbolic, right? It just feels like a real thing. And a big hard dick is a kind of concrete solution to an amorphous problem, right? Like if you have this amorphous problem of feeling surplus, of feeling extra, of, not having the opportunity that you thought you would have, that intergenerationally you were told that you would have. And all of that anxiety can get narrowed into like one object, like a hard penis, then that's going to be a really, really seductive object. And, you know, if it's sometimes there and sometimes not, it becomes a really tantalizing object. And tantalizing, concrete, seductive things have a real pull for people.
Right. And it's neat. You put it in terms of grandiosity and concretization. Like those are the answers that big hard dick responds or provides. That's the answer that it provides. And as a defense against thinking and feeling, maybe you could unpack that.
So it's hard to feel small and it's hard to feel receptive, right? Like these are two things that I think in the unconscious are coded as either female or non-male, right? So if you're a baby, like what are some of the experiences of being a baby, right? It's being at the breast of like just being kind of one with the breast and taking in milk and taking in nurturance and being held. And it's an incredibly powerful experience, so much so that I'd argue that all of us kind of have a primary identification with like this early receptivity that is really like a vulnerable piece of our psyches, and that men particularly tend to try to protect themselves from. The idea of being receptive, of having a female aspect to who they are. in addition, like, you've got from a very early age, like, you know, competition with the father, whether symbolic or real, for attention from the mother. And so he's the guy who comes in with all this bigness, all this hardness, you know, a post-pubescent penis, like, and competes with you for your mother's attention. And so there's aspiration to have that. And when, you know, when anybody feels tiny in relationship to some bigger force, one very early way to manage that kind of fear is to kind of overinflate oneself, not necessarily with any, it's sort of like all superstructure, no base, right? Like, it's, you know, like, puff yourself up because you feel
like all head, no shaft.
Yeah, exactly. Just like giant mushroom on the top. You puff yourself up to feel really big in order to mask a very small feeling. And if that puffed upness can have a kind of concrete aspect to it, sure, it's brittle. Sure, like, you know, pressure on it will make it collapse, but it feels hard and solid in the moment.
Right. I mean, it does prompt the question of, you know, what happens when you actually achieve the big hard dick, the biggest dick. You are the guy who has the dick. Maybe we'll get onto that in a second, but I just want to point out that lest listeners, particularly non-US listeners, think that this is just an American thing. You know, Americans buying their big F-150 trucks to compensate, et cetera, all that kind of thing. The American obsession with bigness. Apparently, as you guys point out in your article, that the country performing the most cosmetic surgeries for penile enlargement is Germany, where surgeons claim to be able to increase the size of the penis by 3 to 6 centimeters in length and 2 to 3 centimeters in girth. Unsurprising then that we have so many listeners in Germany. So, you know, servus, gentlemen. I guess to kind of try to play devil's advocate or preempt a criticism, what's the benefit of this sort of analysis? Because I think, you know, the skeptic will moan that, oh, here are the Freudians again talking about dicks. You guys are just obsessed. Like, this is not so central, where it's kind of, or maybe it's self-evident. Sure, it's better to have a big dick than a small dick. Like, you're kind of inflating this into, no pun intended, inflating this into this whole big thing, which it isn't.
I think whether or not you're interested in the dick per se, there is a need to recognize a sort of, if not just a crisis in masculinity, a sort of crisis in sexuality today. There's like sort of a broader phenomenon of sex recession that we could look at or comment on. That I think is tied again to, so I'm moving away from just the dick to just sex, and now even back even further to an analysis of anxiety today, like probably the most prevalent, psychiatric diagnosis today, anxiety and depression. I think we're interested, or we ought to be interested in a general decline in human pleasure and in the kind of richness of human life at this late stage of modernity. And so we're sort of taking this as our object, but we're interested in I think a broader social phenomenon, anxiety that we can link to socioeconomic and political circumstances that we need to solve. So we're interested in really kind of pinpointing the fact that this is a solution to a problem that has better solutions, or we hope has better solutions. And we try toward the end of the article to point toward the need for political solutions, toward organizing, you know, collective solutions to collective problems. I don't know if
Ben big, wants big, that big more collective there, but penis, yeah.
Well, yeah. It's yeah. Building big things is the name of the issue. But I did want to just, and maybe, I don't know, Ben, if you have anything on this, but there are a couple of, I think, really useful Freudian concepts which are used in the article. One of them is about the fear of castration, and the other is around this kind of primary narcissism. I don't know if either of, I think, Christy, the way that you were laying out there with this, you know, it is about anxiety. That's the starting point. But I think our listeners tend to like a bit of the Freudian terminology, hoping they will. How did you kind of use these ideas of, you know, fear of castration, primary narcissism? Why do they fit here and what do they add?
Well, maybe I can first go back to Alex's point about our critics, right? Like our imagined critics. Our imagined critics might be right. You know, like we might be totally off base here. I think one of the things that psychoanalysis as its best tries to offer is that all of these issues could be multiply determined and we might get it wrong. The thing that we want to do is to be able to think and feel around these kind of topics and imagine that there might be something going on that isn't entirely known or knowable, and to try to bring something else forward. So the idea isn't to say in a kind of repetition of the concretizing or grandiose defense, like we know and we are certain. It's to say, well, what if something else is happening here, in addition to these other material forces that are easier to see? And if that can generate some other ideas, great. But the hope is to have a proliferation of thinking and feeling our way through this, not to say like we're certain and we know. Christy, do you want to talk a little bit about the theoretical pieces?
I think we could tag team it.
Yeah, let's tag team it.
I mean, in the sort of theoretical literature, fear of castration involves a fear of losing something that one actually never had. So the idea of, in like Lacanian world speak, is that the phallus is something that kind of fills in gaps, that, as Ben was saying, kind of emerges as a solution, an imagined solution to the problem that I, baby, lose mom's attention. She's elsewhere. This means mom has a gap. Mom has something that she's missing, and the phallus is what she's going after. I imagine she's going after and sort of discover potentially through the sort of, what's it called? The scene of my parents having sex.
The primal scene.
The primal scene, that it's the phallus that she wants. And so, there's sort of, and this is kind of bound up in our relationship to language, in that, we kind of imagine that words which are polysemic and have many potential routes of satisfaction or of kind of reaching and use, can be shored up and have one-to-one relationships to the objects which they attempt to describe, which is thought of as a psychotic relation to language and to the world, that, you know, for every object, there's a word that describes just that. And I'm kind of interested in a sort of, contemporary theories of the sort of modern life having a psychoticizing effect on the general population, not just neurotics, but, I don't know if that would muddy the water cleared it, but, those are some of the things that go into the fear of castration
element. Yeah, maybe to tag team onto the castration fear. Like,
nice.
If we think about how minds work and how we develop a sense of self, from early on, one of the main ways we develop a sense of self is identification with others in our lives, right? Like, initial experience is a kind of merged and wacky thing. And then eventually, like, individuals start to kind of become defined in our sensory experience against a kind of environmental backdrop, right? So our experience of a mother separates over time from just our experience of a maternal environment. As we recognize that there are other people, one of the ways that we come to understand ourselves is through identification with those other people. And that means having to negotiate this question of difference and of genital difference, especially, right? Like noticing that daddy's got something that mommy doesn't have, or that I have something that mommy doesn't have, or that mommy has something that I don't have. And so when we're really small, and one of the things that psychoanalysis has to offer is that we're all lots of different ages at lots of different times. Like just because we've grown up doesn't mean we've outgrown a particular thought. It's still there in the background alongside other kind of more developmental thoughts. But we have this problem, like, what does it mean that there's difference? And one way that we solve that problem in our minds, I think fairly universally, is imagining that at one time we all had the same body, but something fell off. And that's kind of where we get at the question of castration. And that idea pops up in other places, right, as we grow up. Like the idea of like, well, I had it, but I lost it. It might start there or have a kind of an origin there, but it shows up elsewhere. And that can be why it's important to have a kind of psychoanalytic way of thinking, like what are the shapes of these ideas about how people are, how people relate, what we have, what it means to have something someone else doesn't have, or to not have something that someone else does have. And one way that we think about it is like, oh, that came off. And how did it come off? Did somebody rip it off? Did somebody, did it fall off in my sleep? Like, how did I lose that? It becomes an important question.
No, and I mean, it's not just psychoanalysts who are obsessed with the phallus. I think it's, you know, it's humanity in general. I was looking this up. In Mongolia in 2016, they discovered what is believed to be the oldest example of phallic art, 42,000 years old, a pendant. But in the reporting on this, I was looking this up. The reporting notes that not all experts are convinced. Boston University archaeologist Curtis Runnels told Science magazine he would need to be convinced that this small and rather shapeless object was indeed intended to symbolize the penis. So there you go. It sounds a little bit like a kind of Crocodile Dundee moment. Like, you call that a penis? This is a penis. To kind of move into penis envy and to kind of extrapolate from that, because I think this is obviously the most, I think before I knew anything about Freud, I knew about penis envy and I knew that was the thing that people thought was stupid, right? And then I think like it's the feminist critique of that has been really popularized. I think people are like familiar as that being the thing that makes Freud completely wrong. I think popularly, if I'm correct in that, but I'm interested in whether you think that is indeed the case. But anyway, that it's very closely tied to this notion of imposture, right? Of being the of kind of imposter syndrome of like being castrated, you don't really possess the phallus, and you're always trying to kind of pretend that you do have the phallus, like you're, and so if you're buying the kind of, you know, the products that Big Hard Dick is selling, you're trying to kind of compensate for that. And I'm taking this from something that Todd McGowan said, but I thought it was quite useful. And I think he takes it from someone else. I've forgotten the reference, but he makes a comparison between masquerade and imposter. So masquerade is generally a more feminine sort of attribute or thing that kind of women do, and imposter is something that men do. And so the way that this would be explained out is ways of responding to castration is that, you know, the bald man, this is obviously an example that's dear to my heart. The bald man compensates by wearing a hat, the bald man through imposture puts on a toupee, right? So tries to kind of pretend that no, he indeed has hair. He's not been kind of follicularly castrated. whereas the woman, you know, the woman wears a hat where everybody knows that there's like a bald head under there. So it's like, it's masquerade, right? It's not imposture. There's a kind of, letting the kind of audience know that, you know, I'm covering up here. But that there's a kind of vulnerability underneath, whereas the man tries to kind of disguise it entirely and may fool people, until the toupee slips off. And then it's a much more sort of traumatic experience, I guess. Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting as a way of thinking through this. But to kind of bring it to a more kind of grounded and historically specific sort of discussion, I wonder whether first of all, you think this question of imposture is important and a relevant way to think about this, but also whether you think it's something that's very relevant to today. It made me think of, you know, the kind of professional impostures, or the way that we're all meant to be entrepreneurs of the self. And so we're all kind of, in a way, pretending, particularly as we're meant to be kind of entrepreneurs, and therefore our agency is meant to be across all these different areas, right? We're meant to just kind of be a general professional, right? Whereas if you're doing a specific practice, if you're a carpenter, you're just meant to be a really good carpenter. And so there's maybe less need for imposture in something like that. Whereas if you're meant to be kind of the general hustler, entrepreneur, that there's a lot more of pretending you have a big dick than otherwise, right?
Yeah, I told you before we started recording that I hadn't really thought about this question. But now that we're talking about it, I guess in the background, I have been thinking about it. It's something that occurs in different ways across my practice. I think Ben has said several things that have been just very compelling to me. The first being is that we don't know. And then I think it's very important to stay in that position of that, you know, we're trying to really pull out questions and kind of highlight important questions that need collective solutions. The other thing being, I just lost what the second thing was that was more relevant to this. But it is an important question. It comes up clinically a lot. And what my first thought as you were speaking was just, in addition to the loss of kind of concrete professions where we're making objects, where it's very clear when we have and haven't succeeded in the production of a socially needed thing, I also think that there's just been a real collapse of the spaces in society for playing or for experimenting, in which we could find that something that we think maybe doesn't count for much or isn't enough actually is substantial. And I think that there's just in the kind of constant injunctions that we get from a barrage of advertisements as well as in, you know, occupational and social injunctions, there's just like such a concrete demand placed on people as to how to enjoy and how to produce. And in that space, I really think that the play, the sort of what I'm calling a play space is important because play spaces create, they presuppose performance, that you're kind of performing something. You're maybe not doing the thing itself, but you're putting something on, you're trying something out. And something about like we've just lost some degree of that sense of performance, which would relieve, I think, the sense that I'm fraudulent because I'm not doing right. The thing itself. If I'm just playing at something, if I'm just performing something, I don't have to necessarily be the thing. And I think that we've just, with the collapse of play, we feel the need to be that thing, which maybe is an impossible task, to really step into the shoes of whatever, is being demanded of us.
So just really quickly, because this runs a little bit counter to my presumptions on it, but like, I mean, you use the term performance and you know, there's a lot of talk of performativity today, right? That you're kind of doing this for an imagined audience always, et cetera. And that's very much kind of of a part with the imposture issue, that you're performing, you're pretending something, but your use of performance there suggests something else. It's actually kind of something which would rid you somehow of anxiety, because you'd be like, you're just doing the thing that you're meant to be doing. You're performing it. It's not really you. Right. And that it like it puts me in a mind of kind of the descriptions of kind of like 19th century subjectivity, where everyone wore a mask and you, there's a clear division between public and private, and you're not meant to present the real you. No one's no one thinks that this is like the deep true soul that you're putting out on show. Like, that's okay, that's protected, that's at home and private, and there's a kind of security, I guess, in that performativity, mm-hmm. which is a little bit different to the way that we understand performativity today.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, to pick up on that, I think that what Christie's describing, I think, is playing in the Winnicottian sense, or what she's trying to describe is right. playing, following Winnicott's ideas. And so for Winnicott, like, one of the things that characterizes play is that it's being, it's kind of using the things in the environment towards a dreamlike process of just figuring something out with no known end. That's really different from performativity in the like the sense of having the imagined audience, which Winnicott would probably say is more in the world of a false self, right? Of trying mm-hmm. to create something for that one feels one should be for the sake of compliance. I want to go back to this this question of the toupee and the hat, and the term that you used, I'm forgetting what it was, but the
masquerade, was that
masquerade, and the other one,
an imposture, yeah,
an imposture. Okay, so I think like a important psychoanalytic addition to this idea of imposture would be that it's easy for like us bald men with beards to imagine that we are not the ones doing imposture, that it's the ones with the toupees. But right. what if we thought like, okay, the beard is also readable as a displaced imposture. It's like, you know, I'm choosing to be bald. I can obviously grow hair. Like,
I don't have a t-shirt here, guys. Come on.
I'm wearing it right here on my face. And if we think about it that way, then there's room to think about a split, right? Like, we the bearded bald men, and myself included here, are the ones who have authentically embraced our baldness. And those other guys, we treat them with contempt because they need toupees. But really, all we're doing is displacing our imposture a little further down on our face. I think that castration anxiety or penis envy can be thought about similarly, right? Like, one of the Lacanian kind of interventions into the question of penis envy is to say, like, subjectivity is built on penis envy. It's not just female subjectivity that's built mm-hmm. on penis envy, which is mm-hmm. the kind of feminist critique of Freud. It's to say that, like, you know, no, like, we're all envying that, like, possession of the phallus that we imagine that somebody else has. It doesn't have to do with what someone else actually has. It has to do with this kind of constituent, like, experience of our own lack and trying to make up for that in some way and envy something out there. And so I guess that's what I'd have to say about imposture, that, like, yeah, it seems like a really important concept, but we have to be careful about the idea of like othering it, putting it elsewhere, as opposed to thinking about a kind of universal need to come up with some creative solution for what we lack.
I know George wants to come in, but yeah. I mean, just briefly, I guess also the, like, if you're bald or balding and you shave your head, there's a kind of a move there where you're saying, aha, all you bald men who are pretending wearing hats through masquerade or which fools no one, you know, obviously, but or have a toupee or something like that, you all are, of course, you know, you're all kind of pretending, whereas I kind of accept the reality. I face reality with sober senses and I shave my head, but there's a kind of a lie there too, because you're also saying, well, you're saying, oh no, I'm choosing to be this way rather than, you know, just letting your hair grow out and have it only come out the sides and the back and not the top, for example, which, you know, makes you look like Brian Eno in the 70s, which it's a terrible look, but, you know, there's a reason that there's a reason for that. Anyway, so I guess there's like, I want to move to kind of politics in just a second, but I wonder if there isn't a kind of analogy to be made there, if there isn't like a kind of like a Trumpian move of saying like, aha, the emperor has no clothes, right? Like, oh yeah, all you were bald and you're all pretending. I don't have any of these pretenses, but of course there's plenty of pretenses which the kind of Trumpian move disguises as well. Anyway, George.
No, I think that's interesting. It made me think if there's an analogy here with the kind of, you know, Turkish hair implant industry as well, but that, you know, putting that to one side. I guess one thing which has been sort of mentioned maybe obliquely so far is the kind of, and this is Alex Gendler's piece on the incels. So, I mean, is just kind of take a step back and, you know, is this kind of, I guess what you're talking about here, this kind of penis anxiety industry, it's what's the kind of, I don't know, what's the opposite of the BHD? Is it the kind of the incel, or is it the kind of the nullo? I don't know if anybody's heard about this.
What is that?
You might need a bit of a strong stomach to read some of the reportage on this. And I don't know if this is just a particularly kind of British and maybe Japanese kind of cultural phenomenon, but it's people who are like, embracing castration or kind of, I don't know exactly what the right psychoanalytical language would be, but they kind of get somebody, I was going to say a friend, maybe like somebody they've met online to, you know, to castrate them. So I guess what I'm driving at here are there some other solutions to this anxiety which kind of are equally unsuccessful perhaps, but, you know, can be explained through the same primary mechanism?
I think there are a lot, and there are a lot of different kind of reactions. That was the other thing that Ben said that I wanted to return to, was just that you know, we have basic human conditions that change historically, but we have just so many, just like the particular responses to these are as many as there are individuals alive at a given time. So we can speak to broad trends, but, you know, these things play out at a very, very particular kind of singular level with the individual. I think broadly speaking, I kind of would too crudely split the reactions to the kind of crisis of sexuality, of anxiety, of masculinity that we've been describing into three categories. Maybe there's kind of a, insofar as it's like not cool to be a man today, attracted to men, I think that we see kind of a disavowal of masculinity. Just to be clear, I'm not talking about transgender transitioning, but I think like more specifically, like the I'm not a man's man, I'm like the soft man, the kind of man, like the sort of like feminist men, like the men who like kind of go over and above. It's kind of like funny, like exaggeratedly.
The male feminist, the guy who's, yeah. This is what a male feminist looks like t-shirt.
Right. And then you have obviously like the incel phenomenon on the far end. You have like an incel phenomenon where people are doubling down on traditional forms of masculinity and saying, no, I am a man's man and we need more of these. I would like to say, and I think I have seen kind of plenty of middle of the road solutions though, where people are trying to behave in accordance with a new model or standard for masculinity, redefining masculinity from within it. I think that's very cool personally. I think it's like one of the most cool things and difficult things you can do today, because it requires really suspending your attention, staying with anxiety, really listening to the kind of complex social needs that are alive today. Requires a lot of like sort of patience and calm and ability to work to build something with others. I don't know.
No, that's perfect. I think that's great. And actually leads me on to the question that I wanted to ask. I mean, my impression is that the kind of, you know, liberal elite has, there's a certain response to the populace, which is like to ridicule feelings of smallness or to ridicule the desire for bigness, right? Like I made reference to like F-150 trucks earlier, and that's maybe perfect because it's like completely fetishized as like this thing that hicks want, oh, because it's to compensate for their small dicks or whatever. And like, you should just accept that you're small, like accept it, right? And there's a, you, you know, it, and it's not so easy, I think, as you say in the article, to write off anxieties of smallness, ineptitude, and superfluity as mere fantasies. And that it's very tied intimately to people's prospects in life, material conditions, etc. And I think there's the kind of liberal ridicule of that is completely counterproductive. I mean, it's, you know, and I wonder whether that doesn't itself generate kind of masculinist fantasies as a compensation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're both pointing to that I've been really interested in recently is the question of contempt, right? Because I do think contempt is a kind of anti-political gesture in a lot of ways, that there is this contempt, that this sort of liberal contempt that's pretty easy to see. It's very on the surface. But there are also these gestures that I think any of us can make unconsciously of identifying with the object of contempt, kind of living into like, so if you're going to treat me with contempt, then I'm going to be truly contemptuous, right? Like, and that's not necessarily a conscious process. Sometimes I think it is, but what contempt does is it does kind of stabilize or polarize. It kind of makes a stable, polarized situation that doesn't involve a lot of interest in change. It's just like about locating people. And like, really, what's more contemptuous than telling someone to know their place, right? Which is what the statement is when you say, you know, like, just accept that you're small. But I think that ideally, one of the things that talking about unconscious motivation could do would be to kind of be able to be with really difficult feelings with an openness and without contempt, and with an interest in people's creative solutions. And the thing about creativity is you can't really know what comes next. But if you can come together without contempt, then maybe something new can happen.
No, I think that's really useful. Really useful. I mean, I did wanted to, I don't know if you had any thoughts about, you know, the nature of whether politics becomes kind of necessarily gender coded today, whether there's a kind of right wing populist desire to recover masculinity, which, or, you know, to kind of recover some sort of wholeness, maybe, a response to castration, and whether the kind of liberal left does the opposite, which says, you know, just talks up vulnerability everywhere. I haven't got this entirely clear in my head. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this. Because I also did want to move on to, you know, whether there's a problem with wanting bigness. right. And I mean, maybe there's a limit to how much we can speak in these kind of binaries of small and big. But you know, I think we would all say that we're Prometheans, you know, that the Promethean act of stealing fire from the gods is a good thing. Stealing penis from the god, I don't know if that works. But anyway, I think, you know, the first issue of Damage is called Building Big Things, and that runs contrary to what I think is the more contemporary bias, which is the bias against bigness and in favor of smallness still. Like, you can think of like E.F. Schumacher's famous 1973 book, Small is Beautiful, right? And I don't think it's an accident that came out in 1973. I've made this point before, but like, for me, 1973 is a real pivotal year. It's kind of the end of kind of high modernity as we knew it, the end of the prospects of development, kind of real beginnings of deindustrialization, the turn toward neoliberalism, etc. Like, it's the major, you know, I kind of wrote this piece arguing that the world ended in 1973, and it's taken us 50 years to realize. I don't really mean the world ended, but the kind of the prospects for the future kind of ended then, at least as we knew them. So anyway, I'm kind of babbling, but the idea there is like, what is the kind of political solution, right? I mean, if we recognize this anxiety around, you know, which expresses itself in this desire for bigness, albeit, you know, around penis enlargement, is it wrong to want bigness? In what form do we try to pursue that?
Can I just jump in there as well? Because the way that you frame it in the article is essentially, although in this discussion, is like you have, you know, this what we're really talking about here is, you know, crisis of masculinity, feelings of or realities of being superfluous, anxieties, narcissism, atomization. There's a lot here. I don't know if this makes this a more unfair question, but I think, you know, what do we actually do about this? Because clearly, I think one of the thrusts of this discussion has been, you know, this is a displaced anxiety. What's the real, you know, material solution? Is there one? Please tell us what to do about this problem.
I think we should fuck more. I mean, I think that's probably part of what's needed, right? And I don't mean that just in the sense of like having more sex, which probably people do need to do, but like associate more with one another, have more, mm-hmm. like more contact mm-hmm. is probably what's needed. Because I think that in this discussion of like gendering of politics, there is some way where like that leaves us just in kind of the post-Oedipal idea of what gender is. I think pre-Oedipal gender is a pretty wild like terrain, right? Like where, like we talked about in the article a little, like a nipple could be a penis, right? Like there can be this kind of like possibility of like phallic identification with nurture, right? If it's something like something more like a breast, right? Like in that first intimate scene is, you know, being the baby at the breast and getting something good from sucking. Like that could be a really lively place where, you know, like being the penetrating object is not necessarily male or female. It could be, you know, both and, if we can hold like the Oedipal and the pre-Oedipal in mind at the same time. So I think that one of the problems with this idea of like, is politics inherently gendered, is we get into this kind of concretized idea of what is gender, and really back to what Christy was saying about a kind of like psychoanalytic listening, is that like this idea that gender is just stable is kind of doesn't quite fit with unconscious experience.
Mm. Well, that's very good. I don't know if you wanted to add anything. Otherwise, I was going to say, you know, our hour's up. So that's the end of this session. And like, I feel like getting back all the therapists for that. Ha.
The 50 minute hour. I would say, I mean, just, I think Ben put everything very well. My first thought to your last question here is just that group life has been totally impoverished. We don't have casual spaces to kind of bump into people over a period of time in which to form sort of organic associations and bonds. So really, and that's been replaced in large part by the internet, where there's been this total collapse of play. You know, you just kind of are what you are, and there's not the sort of, there's not intimacy. There's not an opportunity to kind of get to know what you love and hate. There's not an ability, as there is in person, to sort of love and hate aspects of the same person. And so, yeah, getting into IRL encounters, but especially group ones, I think is going to be really important. And there's also, yeah, I mean, it made me think of the kind of like compartmentalization of romantic life to apps now, and how the process of seduction, you know, this question of, is this a sexual encounter or not, which has become too threatening to just have out in the wild, has been kind of, you know, segmented off into the apps. So that answers the question. Okay. This is a sexual or romantic kind of situation. It just seems so hard for people to date without apps today. And, but we have to find some way, I don't know, this is what I was thinking when Ben said, like, have more sex, but maybe, trying to have more sex off of apps too, off the internet. reliance on kind of mediation, but would be helpful.
More performance, more play, more fucking around. Yeah, I think.
I think so. More fucking around. Yeah.
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 Finding out.
And claiming, like moving away from, like, sure, there's always a big other in the unconscious, but like we don't have to like have all of our spaces where we're trying to get intimacy really have this like built-in big other there, like the thing that's gathering the data of exactly what we're doing, right? Which I think is part of what's really problematic about the apps, is it's sort of like this kind of implied consent to have our most intimate moments spied on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's excellent. Fuck around. Don't be afraid to find out. That's a good slogan. Guys, this has been fantastic. Hugely enjoyed this conversation personally. And for listeners, we'll have plenty more of this to come. Plenty more from issue one of Damage, issue two of Damage, which is coming out now. We've also got Dustin Guastella coming on soon to talk about antisocial socialism, drug problems, social decay, and so on. So, of course, watch this space. Thank you for being with us, and we'll catch you next time. See you later. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.